Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger here in the bunker on the February the 10th, 2015 on Tuesday. And I'm going to run a show from way back in 2009 today because my silly doctor gave me some pills to take for pain in my arm and they knocked me out, man. I'm all screwed up, so I'm not going to do this show. I don't know what might come out of me. So here we go, back to 2009 on our little spaceship, our time machine.
Casey Jones, he was a mighty man, and now he's resting in the promised land. The only kind of music he could understand was a big eight-wheeler under his command. He made a freight train boogie all the time. He made a freight train boogie as he rolled down the line. Ringing the bell, everybody along the line could tell. Casey Jones, he was a coming to town on a big eight-wheeler that was burning the ground. He made a freight train boogie all the time. He made a freight train boogie as he rolled down the line. Wake up the people all along the line. Oh, Lord, how the man made the whistle whine. He said to his farmer, better hold your seat. I'm going to make this ride to do the boogie beat. He made a freight train boogie all the time. He made a freight train boogie and it rolled down the line. Roll it, Casey. All the time. He made a freight train boogie and he rolled down the line.
Doc Watson and the freight.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the heartland, in the bunker. Yeah, right here in the central part of this country, or almost central, right. And this is February the 12th, 2009, Thursday. And we're ready to go here at the bunker. I hope you liked our bluegrass music there. We're going to put on some Celtic music from across the pond, too, as time goes on. We were going to do it today, but I missed out on that. We got some straight Irish stuff coming in here, and there's other folk music around the white world that I'd like to be playing one of these days. Yeah. Well, it's a sunshiny day here in the Midwest. And no snow, no rain, and a little cooler today, about 40 degrees, but nice. I'm starting to do my walk after the show, so I do my 3 miles after the show, and it's been real pleasant as long as you put on a warm jacket. Yeah. Well, let's see what we got here in the news. Well, here's an interesting item. Yeah. He did the most to unravel our Constitution. And this is a fitting thing to read today because Obama's celebrating the birthday of Abraham Lincoln. Civil War tyrant, a bad choice to emulate. President Obama was sworn into office placing his hands on the Abraham Lincoln's Bible. That is the last Bible I would use to be sworn into office, you say. Why? Didn't Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation free your ancestors? It all depends where you were living. Let's examine the document's text and see why. President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. It reads, quote, that on the first day of January in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then thenceforth and forever free. The key phrase is in rebellion against the United States, because slaves remain slaves in the states not in rebellion. The proclamation is specific about the states where the slaves were freed, to wit, Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, except the parishes of St. Bernard, Plaquemines, Jefferson, St. John, St. Charles, St. James, Ascension, Assumption, Terrebonne, Lafourche, St. Mary's, St. Martin, and Orleans, including the city of New Orleans, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, except the 48 counties designated as West Virginia, and also the counties of Berkeley, Accomack, Northampton, and Elizabeth City. And York, Princess Anne, and Norfolk, including the cities of Norfolk and Portsmouth, and which except parts are for the present left precisely as if this proclamation were not issued. Slaves in the accepted Louisiana parishes were not freed because those parishes were not in rebellion. Neither were slaves in West Virginia. And West Virginia. By the way, West Virginia's June 1863 admission as a state formerly a part of Virginia was clear violation of the Constitution's Article 4, Section 3, that reads in part, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of the two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress, unquote. Well, what the heck? Lincoln had much of the Constitution under siege by then. The hypocrisy of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation came in for heavy criticism. His Secretary of State, William Seward, said, "We show our sympathy with slavery by emancipating slaves where we cannot reach them and holding them in bondage where we can set them free." The New York World wrote, he has proclaimed emancipation only where he has notoriously no power to execute it. The exemption of the accessible parts of Louisiana, Tennessee, and Virginia renders the proclamation not merely futile, but ridiculous. The London Spectator mocked, quote, "The principle of the proclamation is not that a human being cannot justly own another, but that he cannot own him unless he is loyal to the United States." Lincoln admitted in a letter to his Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase, that his proclamation had no legal justification. Lincoln's motivation for proclamation was the war was going badly for the Union, and there was the possibility that England and other European powers who had recently abolished slavery might give the Confederacy economic and political aid, but would not do so if the war was seen as a war against slavery. An excellent reference for this period is The Real Lincoln by Loyola College of Maryland's economics professor, Thomas DiLorenzo. President Obama can be forgiven for celebrating the hypocrisy of Abraham Lincoln because the victors of the wars write their history and glorify the winners. The recognition of slavery as a despicable institution does not require hero worship of a president who made the largest contribution to unraveling of our Constitution. After all, when it is settled by brute force that states cannot secede, as they thought they had the right to in 1787, then the federal government can ride roughshod over states and their people's rights. In a word, make meaningless the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. This was written by Walter Williams, professor of economics at George Mason University. He also authored the books More Liberty Means Less Government and State Against Blacks, which is later made into a PBS documentary, Good Intentions. I think Walter Williams was black, too. And that's a good article, and that's true. Definitely true. That's why Robert Miles used to always refer to the government as the Federals, the Federals. And a lot of our southern friends down there keep talking about the horrible Federals, which they were. And also, here he is, Obama, today, celebrating Lincoln's birthday, when Lincoln, at least politically, openly, if you can trust anything he said, said he did not believe in the equality of the black race. He said, we'll forever be divided. I believe you should be freed, but once freed, we should be kept separate. And so he said a lot of things along those lines, but maybe like all politicians, he said whatever got him a few yards. Of course, Lincoln corporations started to rise their ugly head about that time, too. Of course, not nearly as much as once Grant got in, the corporations really went wild. Well, you know, we're always hearing about other people doing bad things and criminal things, and especially if a white separatist does something, it never ends talking and bitching about that. Ex-FBI agent faces trial. Man accused of killing son's girlfriend by hitting her with a hammer. As a couple, Jeffrey Prochedo and Kimberly Long were a wreck. Both were using drugs and alcohol, and the police had been called out to their house several times for domestic disturbances, according to Prochedo. Their real trouble started, however, when Prochedo turned to his father, Edward Prochedo Nuno, an ex-FBI agent and Marine, to help him evict Long from Prochedo's house. Prochedo Nuno, 61, confronted Long, and an FBI, retired FBI agent, remember that, keep that in your mind, confronted Long about leaving the house on November 13, 2008. By the end of the morning, Prochedo Nuno was in the hospital being questioned by police, and Long was dead. From blunt force trauma to the head. Prochedo Nuno, as an FBI agent for 25 years, had beaten her with a hammer, authorities said. Prochedo Nuno was in court Thursday for a preliminary hearing. At the end of the hearing, Las Vegas Justice of the Peace, Eric Goodman, ruled that Prochedo Nuno will stand trial for Long's killing. Goodman also granted Prochedo Nuno $250,000 bail, if he can raise it. Prochedo Nuno would have to surrender his passport, wear a GPS monitoring device, and be confined to house arrest. Well, Clark County Prosecutor Giancarlo Pesci argued against bail, saying that Prochedo Nuno had told police he can fly off the handle. Well, you can imagine what he got away with as an FBI agent. If he didn't get away with this yet, but you can imagine a guy who flies off the handle and he has a badge. You know. Prochedo Nuno, who retired to San Diego several years ago, appeared in court in shackles and chains. He didn't speak during the hearing. He may have been one of the famous but incompetent that came up to my house once in a while until they found out it was fruitless. Well, we've got a Guatemalan in trouble here, boys and girls. Yeah, they got a trial starting about a wetback deportation by hospital in Martin County, someplace, wherever that's at. A trial alleging claims of false imprisonment against Martin Memorial Medical Center over the deportation in 2003 of a brain-damaged Guatemala native likely will begin in September, an attorney in the case confirmed. During a trial hearing Thursday, Martin Circuit Judge Elizabeth Metzger, whoa, ordered the parties back in court May 15th in order to tentatively schedule the trial for a week. Attorney Jack Hill, who represents Montejo Gaspar. Okay, so Montejo Gaspar Montejo, the Indian town guardian of former hospital patient Luis Jimenez, said a trial could last 3 weeks. Okay, at trial, a jury will be asked to decide whether Jimenez, who lives in Saloma, Jagujagujango, Guatemala, was kidnapped and falsely imprisoned when Martin Memorial paid to have the brain-damaged man flown to his native country. The records show that the hospital cared for Jimenez for more than 2 years at a cost of $2 million. He suffered a severe brain injury in 2000 when the van he was traveling in was struck head-on by a drunk driver. In 2003, the hospital was granted a court order allowing it to return Jimenez to Guatemala, which an appeals court later determined exceeded the trial court's jurisdiction. Oh, yeah? Isn't that a bunch of crap? Well, here's what our lone wolf friend says. They should have just euthanized the third world invader crud as soon as he was brought into the hospital. American taxpayers paid $2 million for care of this waste of oxygen. What a criminal waste of our money. When are we finally going to say enough? Well, that's what the email says to Tommy. Well, I knew all you guys were waiting for this one. Joom's going to love this. Batwoman is now officially a carpet muncher. Hey, maybe they can make her the president of the Gotham City chapters of Now and Naral. Holy smoke, Batwoman makes her comic book comeback as a red-headed lesbian, billed as a lesbian socialite by night and a crime fighter by later in the night. She replaces Batman, who was himself killed off in a recent issue. Well, there goes the last of the heterosexuals, boys and girls. That's it. Well, let's see whether the boys are trying to put something together here with the draft. William H. Hauser, a retired U.S. Army colonel, and Jerome Slater, a U.S. Navy veteran, just published a heartfelt yet humorous essay in Foreign Policy magazine. I believe Foreign Policy magazine is part of the, what the hell do they call that group? Well, anyhow, entitled Bring Back the Draft, Why a Return to Mass Conscription is the Only Way to Win the War on Terror, unquote. The construct of this modest proposal is surprisingly defensive, given that the authors claim that mass conscription will win the war on terror. I mean, who doesn't want to win the war on terror? Well, first I want a description of terror, because street crime to me is terror. I mean, rape of our women is terror. All that's terror, you know, so you'll never defeat terror, because there's always going to be violence somewhere in the world. And pretty soon they're going to be calling hate crimes terror, too. After describing an ongoing struggle between radical Islam and Western democracy and the lousy state of the American volunteer military, overextended, over-vaccinated, overweight, and overpaid, and don't forget stupid, jamming way over half of the military is black, and then over that is the Mexicans and everybody else. Shit. Well, that's good. Get them out there. Let them get shot at. Hauser and Slater put forth mandatory American national service as a cure.
Hell no. Tommy won't go.
More Americans to man up and prepare to die for the government overseas, with the remainder fearfully indoctrinated on the necessities of eternal service and submission to the state. They immediately list several means to control this massively enlarged military. The new ways to control this necessary expansion of executive power. They agree with libertarians, traditional conservatives, constitutionalists, Democrats, Green Party, and communists. and Terrible Tommy that we should have legal safeguards to prevent presidential unilateralism, in other words, dictatorship. Why don't they just say dictatorship? Beyond the Constitution, that is, many anti-federalists feared that the Constitution had been drawn up to facilitate that very unilateralism. 21st century Americans only know that the Constitution we are taught to worship, but never read, has consistently and abjectly failed to prevent the growth and glory of presidential unilateralism. Thus, the essay trips into comedy with its suggestions in the matter of containment and restraint. It is true, had Bob Higgs been able to explain the nature of the ratchet effect to these military-minded men, their faces would have paled, their hands trembled, their chest heaving. House and Slater proposed that, and I quote it in its entirety. First, Congress should use its constitutionally mandated role in decisions to go to war. Second, Congress should employ its appropriations powers and powers of the purse to prohibit, limit, or end U.S. participation in otherwise unwise wars or military interventions by refusing to fund them. Well, they had every opportunity to do that a couple of years ago. Third, to reduce political opposition to a revived draft, as well as to provide another constraint against presidential unilateralism. A law establishing conscription should include a provision that draftees cannot be sent into combat without specific congressional authority. How you like? Well, we're back with you. We've been leaving the phones open where people can call in. And so once in a while I'm putting you on hold and going over there and talking to somebody on the update. I'll go back to the article here. There's a bit of mystery here, in part due to the fact that the greatest sector of society is missing from the draft debate. As the war on terror has made abundantly clear, neither civil rights activists nor neoconservatives will be caught dead in uniform, draft or no draft, albeit for completely opposite reasons. The founders are history, and in the 21st century we find a majority of their descendants only tentatively discovering their predilections for liberty, or else largely closeted for conformity's sake. The military leadership is by definition dedicated to government service and moot point. If government policy changes, they will support it or simply no longer be military leadership. Spectacularly, focusing on the minutia while ignoring the elephant in the room is a common comedic technique. In this case, Hauser and Slater have contrived a wonderful bit of literary slapstick. We watch the fun with bated breath as the two authors focused and fret on the Lilliputian opposition of three old men and a tired dog, anticipating the moment when they took up and see the giant body of unstoppable resistance, the draftees, their communities and employers, and the wave of taxpayers who will pay for the young and energetic to become temporarily enslaved to do the will of the government that lives and even thrills to spend other people's money as fast as they can rip it from their paychecks, projecting tips and expectant earnings. But the cultural, the guttural, and the gigantic American resistance to universal national service by those it will impact mostly is ignored, and I suspect on purpose. The capstone, this incredibly funny proposal, is in the purported benefits of this new draft. Briefly and incredibly, they are, number one, the military will become a more flavorable, if not fascistic, puree of American race, religion, and class. Politicians will instantly become more responsible, more statesmanlike, more accountable, more moral. Please stop me before I write more. Three, we can't accomplish the mission in Afghanistan if we don't have a draft. The humor here is parody. The military must be all of us. How silly. Even the Spartans didn't go that far. Might we hold the children and the grandchildren of all politicians hostage in the face of their various votes for war, intervention, and exportation of death? Certainly, we may quickly... Pardon me for that interruption. I forgot to unplug that line. Okay, let's see here. Certainly, we may quickly and cheaply implement this fine idea without a universal draft and should do so post haste. Lastly, as we have no national consensus about what we're doing or hoping to do in Afghanistan, why would sending more Americans there be any part of a solution? Well, they want to send, 60,000 more troops, and, of course, a hell of a lot of them are going to be white, mostly from the South. I can't understand it. I catch hell for being sympathetic to the North, to the Federals from some of the Southern boys, but yet the people who volunteer to go into these wars fastest and the highest percentage are Southern whites. Now, Southern whites hate the Feds so bad and the federal form of government that had their boot upon their neck during Reconstruction and so forth. Why would the largest percentage of whites in the country that volunteer to go in the military be from the South? So that's a question I have not had answered by some of my critics from the South. Anyway, in conclusion, the authors proclaim that their modest proposal will soon be welcomed with open arms by all Americans. They write, indeed, the reinstatement of the draft is not an invitation for more war. It may be the best chance for peace. Well, that's true. I think so, too. We need that draft to get peace. If I suspected that the well-crafted and delicately composed Hauser and Slater piece in Foreign Policy magazine, Council on Foreign Affairs, I believe that's their official magazine, was satire of the exceptional sort rather than rarely seen in the American media, I knew it was when I read the last sentence. Upon digesting this proposal, most Americans will respond, much as did the contemporary readings of Jonathan Swift's classic, with, quote, "He's got to be kidding," unquote, or "How utterly cruel," unquote. And some of us will nod to each other and whisper, quote, "What rare subversive genius have we found here?" That's true. Yeah, if they would declare for a draft, universal draft tomorrow, and especially a draft that wouldn't let all the rich kids out and the rich fathers just put them right in the college room and get them a deferment and all that, I think you wouldn't see much fervor for war. If they had a draft at the time Bush decided to occupy Iraq, I don't think he'd have got it done. Yeah. Well, the fellow that sent that to me said, T.T., I can't help but think the draft will be returning to America in the next few years under a far-left black Democratic president, no less. Well, I hope they do bring the draft. I wish they'd bring the draft tomorrow. I think, that would cause spasms in the Pentagon. Spasms, man.
What you saying? Do you need a ticket back to North Dakota?
I don't need nothing from the government.
You're acting kind of tough with somebody done time for nothing but not paying your taxes. I bet you don't pay them now.
Paul still got an attitude. Didn't you learn anything in Leavenworth?
Yeah. I learned that a nigger with a badge is still just a nigger. Yeah.
bit from Extreme Hatred there with Martin Cox. Known Marty ever since he was a little kid. Yes. And I like that first part, didn't you? Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Well, let's see what the KKK's up to here. Hate literature, rise in newspapers. Flyers have derogatory language about black people and give websites and phone numbers for the KKK. Flyers were wrapped around publications, local newspapers. Yeah. Well, I did that by the thousands over my history of involvement. And I don't know what the hell it ever got us, but we're not in power, that's for sure. Fruitland Park police chief wants to have former police officer, Lake County police officer who resigned amid a probe of his association with the KKK, should lose his law enforcement career. That's from the Orlando Sentinel, Orlando, Florida. So here's another case of a guy who just wasn't thinking right. Now, you'd think, well, no, not anymore. I used to think cops were a little smarter than most of them have turned out to be. But you'd think a guy that's got his career on the line, his income on the line, his house payment on the line, his marriage on the line, everything, would have sense enough as a cop not to join a membership organization like the KKK. And go to their rallies and do anything like that. But we see this happen all the time. It's too bad I can't get to these guys before they do this, but I don't know whether they listen or not. But it's just ridiculous to lose your whole career. Once you're outed, you can't do us any good at all anyhow. I mean, what good are you after you're outed? So you stay undercover. Stay undercover. You're going to be a cop, be FBI, ATF, Homeland Security, IRS agent, local cop, county cop, whatever. The hardcore guys, they go underwater. They proceed at periscope level. And they're much more valuable to us in that position. There's a lot of things you can do when you're in that position that you could never do once you're outed. Yeah. Well, let's see here. What's about this? This is from, let's see here. Did PETA go too far with the KKK-themed protest? I guess they turned out in front of some big meeting to call attention to the issue. The organization compared pure breeding. Oh, this was about dogs, I believe. Pure breeding to the Ku Klux Klan's efforts to create a master race. I never heard of the Ku Klux Klan boasting about building a master race. maybe they want to, and maybe I wouldn't mind seeing a master race myself as long as I'm one of the masters. But so they stood out there in front of a, well, that's misrepresentation. KKK should sue those PETA people for ethical treatment of Klansmen. We need a little more ethical treatment of Klansmen. The KKK loves doggies? Oh, here's another article on that. Yeah, let's see here. What else we got here? Inspired, oh, this is from Rochester, Minnesota. Inspired partly by the inauguration, a former KKK member who had been invited involved in badly beating up a young nigger, American divinity student, and civil. Well, let's see, what the hell did he say here? I don't have the whole story up here. Oh, it's all gone, so forget that one. Forget that one. But, you know, some white guy defended himself and beat the hell out of a nigger. See, any time a white guy wins, it's a horrible thing, a horrible crime. It's a race crime. It's a hate crime, everything else. If he loses, it still might be a hate crime. You know, so if you're going to have these fights with these non-whites, try to have them down a dark alley or behind a building or something. Don't do it out on the main drag. Remember that Jew Phil Spector out in Los Angeles, a big shot music boy, music Jew, and he shot this beautiful white girl. I assume she was not a Jew. Well, here a while back, the prosecutors rested their case after 9 weeks of testimony in the murder trial of legendary music producer Phil Spector, who is a total slimeball. His first trial ended in a jury deadlock in 2007. The final prosecution witness was Donna Clarkson, mother of Lana Clarkson, the 40-year-old actress who died of a gunshot through the mouth at Spector's mansion February 2003. Donna Clarkson told a now familiar story of spending her last day with her daughter shopping for new shoes for Lana Clarkson's job as a hostess at the House of Blues nightclub. Her daughter died in the early hours of the next morning. She said her daughter hoped to return to acting in the movies and TV. Clarkson made a splash in the 80s in the star of the cult film Barbarian Queen. Well, anyhow, there you see Specter 69. This white girl's over there. The thousands of white girls go out there, Aryan girls go to Hollywood, get with these Jews. The Jews got the money. They got the Hollywood. They got the movie stuff. And there you go. And this one's dead. Are we going to bet on whether he gets convicted or not? What do you think the bet should be? Let me know what you think. They should be coming back. I don't believe they've come back with a finding yet on him, but if they have, let me know. But I just have a feeling that he'll beat this damn case. Incidentally, in talking about Hollywood, I heard something in regional news here not too long ago that Hollywood is beginning to look to Michigan, especially the Rust Belt up there and all the empty manufacturing buildings and so forth, to start making movies there in southern Michigan. So you're gonna have to fight with the niggers for these jobs. But I'll tell you one thing, that if I were you and out of work, I'd be watching this very carefully and trying to find out all you can about it, because there's a hell of a lot of jobs go along with making these movies. Everything from set designers to carpenters to everything, you know, and then actors and everything. So I would say get with your state government there and try to keep an eye on what's developing there and who you call about getting a job if this actually comes to fruition. So just a tip, because if Hollywood's going to make a bunch of movies there, they're going to be pumping a lot of money into southern Michigan. You know, you guys, we've been talking about UFC fighting and cage fighting. You know, back in December, this damn Nigger Evans took out Griffin in the UFC. You got to get going here, because the whites have totally had in the past controlled UFC, and there's no reason they can't do it now. And all you young guys, let's get in there. You know, forget about marching down the street. Forget about hanging out at rallies and your buddies that are just drinking beer and singing Sieg Heil. Get into a gym. Get a group of guys. Start training. Let's move into this UFC thing. Let's get you boys in there. It's a big money operation, and you can beat the hell out of non-whites and not get charged with it. So I'd like to see that. Well, this is always good news. I mean, you know, this is fantastic news out of Washington. Suspect caught after student fatally stabbed. A 22-year-old graduate student who had arrived on campus at Virginia Tech 2 weeks ago was decapitated with what the university officials said was a kitchen knife at a cafe on campus Wednesday night. I realize this is a little bit older news, but I didn't know who all was involved. Officials at a news conference Thursday said they waited to release the grisly details of her killing until they could contact a translator and notify her mother in China. Xing Yang, 22, a graduate student from Beijing, had arrived on campus January 8 to begin studying accounting in the Pamplin College of Business, officials said. Yang was killed at Ah Bon Pain Restaurant. Another graduate student, Haiyang Zhu, 25, from Ningbo, China, has been charged with first-degree murder and is jailed without bond. Well, yeah, well, that's things are looking up if when the invaders start killing the invaders. Yeah. Hey, Thomas, first off, I just sent some money for the show to get me through June. Now I've heard you say a couple of times that Woodrow Wilson wasn't a Jew. I could be wrong, and you may have already been through this, but wasn't his real name Wolfson? Then Wolson, W-O-H-L-S-O-N, then finally changed to Wilson. Jack Otto used to bring this up from time to time on the Intel report. You can also Google it and get a few of the references. As for the Intel report, Ghost Wolf Frank brought up a reference about not looking at your prey as you're about to pounce. Mark brought that up a couple of times to me, and recently on his hour also, using scale, army men, and buildings and so on for planning. I got a kick out of it when I heard Frank talk about that on his 259 talk. He is doing a bang-up job, and so are you, Tom. Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, right. Well, I'll look into that. I never knew, and, you know, over the years, I've read a lot about Wilson, but I didn't read that. I'll check it out. Well, I forgot to tell you, boys, due to the income problem that people are having, that beer drinking seems to have taken somewhat of a plunge. However, a lot of it has to do, too, with people buying the beer and taking it home. But oddly, we find that some of the small, real small brewers, local brewers, backyard brewers, or whatever you want to call them, they're doing great. I heard one fellow interviewed that had a little brewery. They only did 700 gallons at a time, and he says he can't keep up with it. There's someplace down in Texas. You know, the United States is the biggest beer drinkers in the world. And but they're building down in Mexico, down south of the border, they're building the world's largest brewery right now. They're putting it together. And they say it looks like a moon station. It's a giant thing. They're going to be bottling 7,200 bottles of Corona a minute. 7,200 bottles a minute. So, that's, you know, Corona is one of the most, the best import beers. And I must say, I've had Corona beer, and it is better than many of the so-called American beers. But now, Budweiser's, I believe, built a big brewery in I believe it was China, and so forth. So, anyhow, 7,200 bottles of beer a minute, man. They're really pumping them out. And south of the border, down Mexico way. Well, in Hartford, Connecticut, a nigger judge, one of the first black female judge, used racial slurs. A judge charged with drunken driving and videotaped using racial slurs while arguing with the police officers. She was suspended without pay Monday for 8 months by a judicial review panel. Superior Court Judge E. Curtissa Cofield was confirmed as Connecticut's first black female judge in 1991, apologized to the State Judicial Review Council. Well, I wonder whether that would be a hate crime there. That was sort of an attack on the police. I wonder if they were black police, whether she called them niggas, or if they were white police, she just called them white honkies. I'll bet they were nigger cops. That's funny as hell. Yeah. Oh, I didn't read on down the article. Yeah, she was arrested the night of October 9th after her car hit a Park State police cruiser. Oh, jeez. In a construction zone on Route 2 in Glastonbury. Police said she told them she hadn't had any alcohol
But she failed the sobriety test and the urine test later that evening and showed she had blood alcohol level of twice the legal limit of 0.08. She also argued with the state and Glastonbury police officers. A surveillance camera at the Glastonbury Police Department captured the exchange on video, which shows her using the N-word, calling black state trooper Negro, threatening the she called him a nigger, threatening the trooper's job, referring to a female officer as a little girl and Barbie, and using other offensive language. When I watched the video, I did not recognize myself, Cofield told the consul. The woman I observed that night was not the woman I really am. No, you're worse, you bitch. Cofield acknowledged that her conduct was reprehensible, but said she did not willfully violate conduct of code because her judgment was impaired by her intoxication. I'm not to blame. I was drunk. Oh, Judge Susan S. Reynolds appeared to stump Cofield when she asked why Cofield's comments were not racist. Quote, why it's not racism, I think for crimes like bias you have to have intent, Cofield said. Quote, all I can say is I was really drunk and I can't explain it. Why is it not racism? I don't know. But if it is, or someone perceives it that way, I apologize for that. Yeah. Oh, man. Hypocrisy abounds. Well, I've got exciting news here, I'll tell you that. Now, you can't believe India to launch cow urine as a soft drink. Yeah. Yeah, this is from New Delhi News. Does your Pepsi lack pep? Is your Coke not the real thing? India's Hindu nationalist movement apparently has the answer. A new soft drink made from cow urine. The bovine brew is in the final stages of development by the Cow Protection Department of Rashtriya Swayamsevaka Sangh, India's biggest and oldest Hindu nationalist group, according to the man who makes it. Om Prakash, the head of the department, said the drink called Gau Yal, or cow water in Sanskrit, was undergoing laboratory tests and would be launched very soon, maybe by the end of the year. Don't worry, it won't smell like urine and will be tasty too, he told the Times from his headquarters in Haridwar, one of the four holy cities on the River Ganges. Its USP will be that it's going to be very healthy. It won't be like carbonated drinks and would be devoid of any toxins. Well, maybe you would be better off drinking cow piss than drinking Pepsi and Coke. I mean, you know, one of the worst things for your health around, probably as bad as cigarettes, is drinking all these soft drinks. And that's where so many people are growing into monster babies. I mean, it's 300-pound ladies going around with one cheek of their ass bigger than my whole body. So, judged against that, maybe cow piss wouldn't be so bad, but I'll let you guys try it out first. But this gives you an idea of these damn Indians. And these, we're bringing them, they're coming over here like mad. Corporations are bringing them over here like mad. And they're talking about this society. I have Indians that have emailed me and told me what a horrible guy I was and all this kind of stuff, and how superior they are to us. And then, you know, they're still worshiping cows over there. I mean, come on. Oh, God, give me a break and give me a drink. Oh, not that yellow shit. Also from India, I forgot to tell you, there's these bunch of radical Hindus over there offering cash rewards for killing Christians. So the Christians can die for the baby Jesus. How about that? Well, 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 I see here U.S. troops in black helicopters invade New Orleans and drop bombs. The New Orleans Police Department, along with 150 active-duty U.S. troops, are currently engaged in what they describe as military training as black helicopters whiz around the city dropping bombs in the latest example of Americans being incrementally conditioned to accept a state or de facto martial law. I heard a bunch of explosions starting at
10 p.m. They were about 10 seconds apart. And then they'd stop, and we thought it was over. But then they started again. Well, how about that? Another reason for the niggers to get out of New Orleans. You probably heard about this guy down in Arizona who's waged a 10-year campaign to stop the flood of illegal immigrants from wetbacks from crossing his property. He's being sued by 16 Mexican illegal aliens who accused him of conspiring against their civil rights. Well, guess who's behind that? Yes, you're right. Morris Dees is right in the middle of that thing. Yeah. See, I told you a long time ago when they came after Bob Shelton of the UKA, and then they came after me, and they came after Pastor Butler, and now they're going after everybody else. Anti-abortionists, anti-illegal alien guys, and the whole bit. So there's Morris Dees, boys. Everybody sort of chuckled and looked the other way when it happened to some of the rest of us. So now everybody's in the shit because of Morris Sleaze Dees. Well, 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 what do we have here? A Fox News producer who covered Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign for the cable network is facing child porn charges after federal agents discovered photos and videos on his computer depicting children under the age of 10 being sexually abused by adult men and women. Aaron Brooms, 29, and he's got a picture of him here, he's some kind of a wog, could be a Jew, I don't know, was apparently nabbed after a Pennsylvania State Police investigator conducting a proactive undercover investigations on an unnamed peer-to-peer network determined that Bruno's computer contained illicit images, according to an arrest warrant affidavit filed in U.S. District Court. An FBI search of a Dell laptop in Bruno's Washington, D.C. home turned up several photographs and videos showing the sexual abuse of children as young as 5 years old. A copy of the Federal 6 affidavit can be found below. The day before his P Street apartment was raided, Bruno's pictured at Wright filed a new FoxNews.com story about Clinton and Joseph Biden delivering farewell speeches on the Senate floor. This is the second time Bruno's has been arrested for possessing vile images. In July of 1999, Bruns, then 19, pleaded guilty in Michigan, where he was enrolled in college for distributing child pornography over the Internet. He was sentenced to 3 years probation. Bruns was collared in the earlier case after a Florida law enforcement official discovered his illicit online activities when police raided Bruns' University of Michigan dorm room. They discovered about 6,000 porno images of children on his computer hard drive. Well, Bill O'Reilly, what do you got to say about this, Billy boy? You know, the Fox Network, the great Republican Party spokesman, God, Motherhood, and Apple Pie. You knew the guy was into porno a long time. You hired him. You hired a child porno guy for Fox. What about that there, Mr. O'Reilly, baby? Well, here's one of these guys that wanted to go back to his roots. He went lived in Canada. They went back to Ireland. After 16 years in Canada, I came home to Ireland. Big mistake. A really big mistake, writes Brendan Landers. There are three types of people who uproot themselves and immigrate to make their lives anew in a country that is not their own by birthright. Some are gifted with itchy feet and a lust for adventure. They abandon their homeland to satisfy their curiosity about the wide world beyond. Some are fortunate enough to happen upon a foreign place that touches their soul or to bond with a person who makes the prospect of migration more attractive than a life lived at home without the other. And some are forced to immigrate because their native place has nothing substantial to offer them in life. Most of us who left Ireland during the 1980s fell into the third category. We went away not because we had itchy feet, had found our El Dorado or fallen in love with an exotic foreigner, but because Ireland had nothing to offer us, no jobs, no opportunities, no scope to follow our dreams or aspire to even a modicum of successful life. The Irish economy was broken, and it would take a miracle to fix it. Along with the dismal state of the nation's finances, there was a sense of whatever wealth existed was hoarded greedily by a coterie of well-acted professionals, wide boys, and golden circles. The land of our birth offered us nothing but tacit encouragement to leave. Brian Lenihan, Sr., the father of our current Minister of Finance, put it succinctly when he said, quote, "Sure, we can't all live on this small island," unquote. Immigration was expected of us, and so, forlorn and abandoned, we departed. We overcame our grief, our disappointment, our homesickness, our longing for the day-to-day company of our friends, family, and friends. We settled and went about the business of building new lives for ourselves in our homes, away from home. We didn't expect to live in Ireland again. Then, after a decade or so of exile, a sequence of remarkable events conspired to persuade us that maybe miracles can happen after all. We watched agog as Ireland underwent an awesome transformation. The country transmogrified from an impoverished backwater racked by unemployment and a culture of despair into the epitome of cool and a glamorous hothouse of self-indulgent affluence. Of course, Tommy says they brought in a lot of niggers at the same time, and Packies and everybody else. U2 became the biggest rock and roll band in the world, and unlike previous Irish rock stars such as Van Morrison, Thin Lizzy, Rory Gallagher, and the Boomtown Rats, who all invariably moved to London at the first taste of success, they stayed in Dublin. Jim Sheridan and Neil Jordan directed the world-class movies that won Oscars, and they stayed in Ireland instead of moving to Hollywood. Alan Parker made a movie of The Commitments, and Roddy Doyle bestrode the world of literature, won the Booker Prize, and didn't move to Paris or New York. By virtue of Michael Flatley's dazzling footwork, Riverdance created a sensation in theaters throughout the world, and Flatley actually moved to Ireland. The IRA declared a ceasefire, and the country was at peace, all but tentatively so. Michael D. Higgins served as Minister for the Arts, Culture, and Gaeltacht, a poet in cabinet, for God's sake. It was like 1916 all over again. Tribunes were exposing corruption in a host of established institutions. There was much heady talk of a brave new world of openness, honesty, transparency, and ethics in public life. Hope peeped out from under the carpet. Mary Robinson, a principled liberal woman, won the presidency and put a candle in the window of her residence in the Phoenix Park as a beacon of light to welcome home the children of diaspora for us. This was a revolutionary act of sensitivity unprecedented in the country's history. Well, it's a long article. I'm not going to go on with it, but everything happened to him. Everything went to crap, and he left Ireland again, I guess. Yeah, so that's sometimes that greener grass on the other side of the fence is not as green as you think. Yeah. Well, boys and girls, that's about it for today. We'll close out here with a little music, and you'll be back with us tomorrow. Tomorrow is Friday already. This is Thursday.
Yeah. Well, there we go. That's about it for today, and that was 2009. I think it said February. We got them all, and we're going to start streaming these shows. We got the equipment. We got it pretty well. We got the service, and so we're waiting on merchandise resist at yahoo.com, the webmaster, to tell us about the glorious day, and then we'll find out how we do it. I don't even know how we, how we reach it, but anyhow, that's coming up, so... And the pill's starting to wear off now. I'm getting back. Boy, I was woozy and dizzy. Boy, I shouldn't even drive a car when I take one of those. I'm not going to take any more of those damn things, I'll tell you. I'm out of here. 14.5. Oh, yeah, before I forget it, there is a series. You can get the whole series at the video store or probably find it on the services on the Internet. And it's called The Following. Well, I want to tell you something. If you want to watch a series that makes the FBI look like stupid idiots, I mean really hardcore story and show what a underground, a really well-oiled and perfected underground organization can do. Even we're not making judgments on what they did, but the tactics they used and the depth of infiltration they used is fantastic. And watch the following. I think you'll find that to be true.
Who are these people he recruits? They can't all be serial killers.
He is recruited from all walks of life. Housewives, teachers, accountants, military, law enforcement.
All of whom fit the personality types associated with cult susceptibility. And